Yeah, the other, so give me some other implications of making Jesus a model for Catholic schools. Anybody have another suggestion that occurred to you? Somebody said something to you at the break, at the coffee. Well, let me make just a couple of other deep values, especially that are particularly Catholic, that should and could and might and ought to shape the curriculum, the ethos, the whole ethos of a school. And these are just some brief suggestions. Catholicism at its best has a tremendous conviction about the potential goodness of the whole person. Now that may surprise you, because it's not always what we learn in school. And yet it was one of the issues around which we parted ways with the reformers. The sense that we're all made in the divine image and likeness. Now a lot of this we've said already, that we're alive by the very life of God, that the divine life is breathed into us and Adam becomes alive with the life of God, but that there's an innate goodness to the human condition, that it ultimately, the great debate at the time of the Reformation was, are we sinners in the hands of an angry God, or are we good people in the hands of a loving God? Totally different positions. And the Catholic response was to say that we're basically good people in the hands of a loving God, rather than bad people in the hands of an angry God. And Calvin, in many ways, kind of triggered the debate, because Calvin was basically saying that we're a mass of peccati, we're a mass of sin and corruption. But when the Catholic Church regathered at the Great Council of Trent, it said, no, we're based that the original grace is not lost by original sin. We're capable of dreadful sin. But basically, we have an innate goodness to us, which gives us great potential and possibility. It's very significant. It demands a holistic kind of education where we would educate all the capacities, not just the academic, but the spiritual, the relational, even the physical, the aesthetic, the ability for the arts and so on. The whole person would need to be educated to become fully alive to the glory of God. A basically positive outlook on life. Justin and I stopped today on the way down and just to stretch our legs. And I heard two people over, one person said to another, how are things? And he immediately said, there's no use in complaining. And I immediately thought, now that's a typical good Catholic attitude. There's no point in complaining. There's an old gentleman that lived down the road from where I grew up as a child up in Kildare, and Joe. Joe was a very, very impoverished man in economically and in physically as well. He had all kinds of challenges, physical challenges. But whenever you say to Joe, how are things, Joe? Joe would say, not too bad, not too bad. We often take these things for granted, but a good Buddhist would never say that. A good Hindu would never say that. Now that have other perspectives. But it comes deeply out of this sense that God's effective love, God's spirit, empowers our own good efforts, the nature-grace partnership that I talked about earlier. Encourages in a sacramental outlook to see the more in the midst of the ordinary, to see the ultimate in the everyday, to see God in all things. It lends a transcendent ground of meaning, of purpose to our lives. Promotes a bonding with all people, that we are made for each other, that we're responsible for and to the whole human family. It's what we mean by the word Catholic. When Augustine and Prosper of Aquitaine, and indeed it goes back to Ignatius of Antioch, the first to use it about the year 105, 106, to describe the Christian community, he called it Catholic. And he meant it to mean what etymologically it means, to include everyone, that everyone has to be included in our love, in our concern, in our care, in our welcome, in our hospitality. And it's to educate, so we educate people then for their own good, but for the common good, and to form good citizens, and you do that very well. It's a wisdom way of knowing. As I said, I'm going quickly through these, so if anyone wants to spend time with them, I'm happy to share the overheads with you. But this is one that surprised people. This is the one that Benazir Bhutto mentioned. That it's a different way of knowing that arises out of Catholic Christian faith, and I can give you chapter and verse in Augustine, Aquinas, all kinds of people up through the years, it would take us too long now. But the real epistemology of Catholic education is indeed to get people to pay attention to the data and to understand it. But you can't stop there. If they're to move on, if they're to come into wisdom rather than just simply knowledge, we have to encourage them to make judgments and decisions. This is when they reach beyond knowledge to a wisdom for life that shapes their whole personhood, their outlook, their values, their self-understanding. But the key is to push on. That I suppose we can become so obsessed with numeracy and literacy and teaching for exams and all the rest of it. But very often that's simply to stop at understanding. Get people to know the data and be able to put it into their own words. But if we ask them great questions like, what do you think yourself? And does that make any sense? And what difference would that make if you took it seriously? And do you think that's true? And do you think that's good? Do you think that, what do you think? And what will you do with it? How would you put it to work? If we don't do the judgments and decisions, we won't educate for their whole selves, their outlook, their values, their self-understanding. And it's a combination of both critical reason and divine revelation. These are partners. They're not competitors at all. We can be committed to academic excellence and to formation in gospel values. Because people often say to me, how can you be academically excellent, a great school, if you're doing all this airy-fairy stuff? It's not, it's anything but. Let me push on a little bit into the last 20 minutes or so, we've been talking about educating from a faith perspective. I want to reflect a little bit with you at least on educating for a faith perspective. And I've been doing a different kind of workshop with other groups throughout the country, and I've been asking the question, can we educate for faith? I mean, in some ways, it's easy enough to do religious education. You can take religious data and dole it out in doses and teach it the way you would teach math or social studies or whatever. But can we teach, can we educate for faith? And can we do that throughout the whole curriculum? Is it feasible? Or is Ireland moving beyond all this? For the curriculum of religious education at Catholic school, I want you to look at these questions, and I'm going to ask you to have a chat with the neighbor very briefly. What would you say, when you think about the religious ed curriculum of a Catholic school, what would you want students to come away from that curriculum? What would you want them to come away knowing? That's my first question. My second question is, how would you want them to know it? In other words, at what level of their being? What would you want people to know, and how would you want them to know it? From the religion curriculum. In a Catholic high school, let's say in a Catholic high or grade school either, but in a Catholic school, what would you think? We'll stay together because the time, tempus fugits.
To have values.
To have values, yeah.
In such a way that they can apply it to their own lived lives afterwards.
That they can apply it to their lives, absolutely. Pardon? To feel valued themselves, that they're valued, absolutely, that they're highly prized, that that to be truly to feel themselves as deeply valued and valuable. What else would you want them to know? To treat others as they want to be treated themselves. Do unto others as they'd have them do to you. The golden rule. You want them to know the golden rule for sure. What else do you want them to know?
I suppose it's their own personal journey of faith, as opposed to the schools or the churches. It's how they internalize it.
Yes. And that there is this use of this personal relationship with God. It's an extraordinary thing to give young people a sense that you have a personal relationship with God. And you know what? You can even talk to this God, and this God will hear you. And if you listen deeply to your own heart, you may even be able to hear this God speaking to you. I mean, talk about giving a young person a sense of dignity, a sense of importance, a sense of value, a sense of cherishing of themselves, a sense of confidence. They can go to this God with whatever they have. And this God will love them unconditionally, will confront them and cajole them and invite them, and yet will always love them, forgive. There's nothing they can do. I was rereading Julian of Norwich last week with my graduate students, and her whole conviction was there's nothing we can do that'll stop God from loving us. Now, we can do sins and all kinds of things, and God doesn't approve of that at all. Of course not. And yet God won't stop loving us. And she has this beautiful image. You know, so often we talk about different ways. I mean, St. Paul had 20 different ways of talking about what difference did Jesus make to human history. Cur Deus Homo. Why did God become a person in Jesus? And we have many metaphors and models for responding. Salvation, redemption, liberation, humanization. But Julian's way of explaining it was that God became one of ourselves and planted himself entirely in the human condition. So that when God would look upon us, God wouldn't see us, but God would only see Jesus. Would see God's own Son. And would always then love us and have mercy on us. Because Jesus has totally, and her image was that when Jesus fell into the womb, Adam fell into the ditch, Jesus fell into the womb of Mary. And now that God looks upon us, God only sees the face of Jesus. And is always merciful and is always loving toward us. Extraordinary, tremendous richness of those in the feminine and the old women mystics. We're just discovering Hildegard of Bingen and Julian of Norwich and all these great mothers of our faith. Extraordinary that the faith they had, and where did they even get the education? Because it was all against the grain. But the tremendous sense of the value of each and every one of us. But to give young people that sense that God will always love them. I mean, it's an extraordinary gift. It's an extraordinary gift to nurture in young people. And from what you've said, you see, that stuff, they'll know it in their heads, but they'll have to take it into their hearts. You'll have to somehow teach in a way that will encourage them to take it to heart. I think religion as education, there should be only one S in ass up there, a Catholic, donkey, no, I'm kidding. But to educate for faith in themselves, faith in others, faith in life, faith in God, faith in Jesus. Very simple. I propose it, and so I've written big books about this. It can be very said in about 10 minutes, so don't tell anybody, because I have people who come to study with me for 2 years, and it takes about 10 minutes, actually, to say it all. A life to faith to life. You get people to bring their lives to their faith, and their faith to their lives. And what I'm going to propose is that we can teach faith traditions in such a way that they learn about it. And this is where I want to tie it in with a concern you might have. Because can we make religious education an exam subject? You know, and the junior cert, the leaving cert, and yet, you know, and influence their lives. And Michael Grimmett has a nice way of putting this. He's a great English religious educator. But we've always thought there's only two options. Either you get them to learn about it, and you teach it objectively, as they call it, as if that is possible, or you get them to become it. And you see an awful lot of people say, well, the schools shouldn't be doing that, and we don't want doing that, and now our schools have all kinds of students from other traditions and what have you, and we can't be imposing this faith on them and so on. But there is a middle ground. Beyond learning about it, and probably short of becoming it, although if that's their choice and if that's appropriate, then of course we encourage that, but at least they can learn from it. And especially Christian faith, but any of the great religious traditions, they're great traditions of spiritual wisdom that can enrich people's lives. They can learn from it for their lives, even if they don't become it. I taught undergrads at Boston College for 35 years and tried to all, and I had Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, all kinds of traditions in my classes. And I would say, I'm not just going to teach, and the course was called Catholicism 1 first semester, Catholicism 2 second semester. And I'd say to them, I'm not going to just teach you about Catholicism. I'm going to try it in a way that you might learn from it, that you might become a better Muslim, a better Jew, a better whatever. Murphy, you might become a better Catholic from your exposure to this great tradition. Get them to learn from the wisdom of it all. And then you give that the religious ed curriculum of Catholic schools is to persuasively access the truths, the spiritual wisdom of Christian faith, at least in a way they learn from it, and disposing students as appropriate, perhaps to embrace it as their identity. You're not opposed to that, and yet that's you're not imposing it either, for sure. And I think it requires a pedagogy that engages students' everyday lives. What Paulo Freire, one of my own mentors in life, called their generative themes, their heart's desires, getting into the deep heart's core, as Yeats would call it, when he wrote the Lake of Isle of Innisfree. And then in the midst of that, give them access to the scriptures and traditions of Christian faith or whatever faith. You may be teaching a course in world religions, especially at a senior level, in ways that they invites them to integrate, to take the spiritual wisdom and to put it into, bring it into their lives, and maybe to embrace it as their identity. When you stop and think about, because I'm going to propose, not only are we to teach Jesus as the heart and soul of Catholic education, I think we've something to learn from how he taught, and especially by way of religious education. Now, when you look at him there teaching people, what would you think of as his approach to pedagogy? What do you think of as his pedagogy? How did he go about teaching? He's described as a teacher 150 different times. So it was his primary ministry. We always think of him as preaching. In fact, he was a teacher, an educator. He was a Catholic educator. He was a religious educator, Jesus, his primary function. And also, we always think of him as talking. Somebody who counted it, 313 times in the four Gospels, he asks questions. Constantly asking people great questions, not just telling them great truths, but asking them good questions to reflect about, who do you say that I am? Thousands, hundreds and hundreds of questions. What would you think? What was his style?
Looks like he's enjoying
himself. I think he probably was. Yeah, I think he probably enjoyed it. Loved kids, loved people, had a great passion for the old, the young, men, women, the ordinary, the everyday. All were welcome. What would you say?
Leading by example.
Leading by example, yes. Leading by example was certainly part of his style.
He probed.
Pardon?
He probed.
Probed, yeah, he definitely did. Asked great questions. Got people to think, to question, to reflect on their lives and the world.
They wanted to listen to him,
there's
no bell there.
Yeah, they do, they're definitely.
He,
but how did he engage them? Like, how did he get them interested? Very invitational, yes.
Part of the group.
Pardon?
He's part of the group.
He's part of the group too. Yeah, he's in the middle of them.
He told
great stories. He told great stories. Great way to teach. Another one maybe? Well, I'm always amazed, because I've made a career out of this approach. I think we can be inspired by his pedagogy. He appealed both, and this is taking both to logos and eros, both to reason and desire. He got into people's heads, but he also got into their hearts. And their desires for love, for happiness, for meaning, for hope, for faith, for you name it. He was constantly appealing into people's desires as well as into their interests. And his intent all the time was to get people to integrate life and faith into a living faith. I think his overall pedagogy, I propose, was to lead people from life to faith, from faith to a life in faith. How did he do it? Constantly began every pedagogical moment by engaging people's everyday lives, their interests, their ordinary everyday concerns, cares. Reign of God is like sorting fish. Reign of God is like a sorghum and some seed. Reign of God is about women baking bread. Reign of God, there was a family with two sons. One of them said, give me half of the property. There was the beggars at the gate. There's vineyard keepers looking for workers. Look at the birds of the air. Look at the lilies of the field. Look at the buds on the trees. You know the summer is nigh. He constantly began with the ordinary and everyday of people's lives and got them interested. I think that's, if you go back to the photo, I think that's why they're interested. Because he was talking about what matters to them, the ordinary and the everyday of their lives. I defy you to find more than a handful of instances of him teaching where he doesn't begin with something from their ordinary and everyday, their own interests, their own concerns, their own lives in the world. And then he got them to reflect on their reality and sometimes turned their world upside down, got them to see in a whole new way. In other words, and then so the Samaritan becomes the neighbor, the prodigal is welcomed home, Lazarus goes off to heaven, and the rich man to hell, would have turned people's world upside down, because the assumption was that wealth was a blessing from God, poverty was a punishment. But he turned their world upside down, constantly getting them to see in a whole new way. But then taught his gospel with authority. And by persuasion, by reason, began with their lives. Taught it, but he wasn't just a discussion leader. He definitely taught a substantive curriculum, as you might say. But then encouraged people to see for themselves with personal conviction, and indeed to come to some kind of decision and something to do with it, to follow his wisdom way as disciples. But that beginning with their lives, getting to think about it, go to the faith tradition, bring it back to life again. It goes all through the scriptures and yet is writ large on the road to Emmaus. Now, it'll take too long to go through that text in any detail, but when you go home, maybe take out your Bible or tomorrow morning or tomorrow night and look at Luke 24, 13 to 35. It's this amazing example of him, of the teacher, of Jesus. Well, by now he's the risen Christ at work. And basically, he joins their, they're coming out of Jerusalem on Easter Sunday morning, two of the disciples, and he joins their company and walks along with them. And they're prevented from recognizing him. And he says to them, "What are you discussing as you go upon your way?" Now, he knew what went on. They said, "All the things that went on in Jerusalem. Are you the only one who doesn't know the things that went on in Jerusalem?" He said, "What things?" In other words, he gets them to tell their story and their shattered vision. We were hoping he was the one who would set Israel free. But he begins with their own life, as Freire would say, with their own realidad. What's going on? What's happening? Tell me about it. And then, only then does he turn to Moses and all the prophets and begin to explain the scriptures to them. And then, but waits for them to come to see for themselves. And they come to see for themselves in the breaking of the bread, whereupon he vanishes. In some ways, his work was done. And then they go back into a living faith. That was just a picture of them on the road to Emmaus. But I think when we're teaching any religion or any faith tradition, that we somehow have to begin to engage students' lives with real life themes and issues. I think then we can access the spiritual wisdom of Christian faith or Muslim or whatever, as I said, if you're doing a course in world religions or something. We can lay out the story and vision as pertinent, and then you can encourage them to see for themselves. I was doing a lesson not too long ago. I was trying to teach a demonstration class, and the topic they asked me to teach was the Blessed Trinity. Now, that's as abstract as you can find. And how do you begin? Very briefly, I've dated myself. I began by playing the Beatles record, "What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love." And I explained to the students that the Beatles came just after the dinosaurs. That's about the era of it. But then I gave them the words, we played the song, we listened to it, and I said to them, "What do you think? Is it true? Does the world needs now, all the world needs now is love, sweet love? It's the only thing there's just too little of." And we talked about that, and then we began to talk about, what does it mean to love? What does it mean to be in love? Think of somebody you really love, deep down, somebody you're passionately in love with. It could be your mom, your dad, a friend, your little brother, little sister, your aunt, uncle, your granny. Hopefully you're deeply in love with somebody. Who is it? Why are you in love with them? Why do you think you love them? Why do you think you need to love them? What does it mean to truly love them? What's a good love? What's a destructive love? When do you know you're really in love? We went on and on and on, and they were talked about their loves and all the rest of it. And then you begin, but only at that point you begin to say, you know, God bless you, at the heart of Christian faith, we've got this extraordinary old dogma about that our God is a God of triune love. And that God, this is what we mean by the Blessed Trinity. And then you can be as academic, as rigorous, as reflective, as well-informed as you can teach with great academic excellence then about the Blessed Trinity. and what this means. That we used to say, I was telling the students, we used to say as Catholics especially, the Blessed Trinity, it's a mystery, you can't explain it. Well, it's still a mystery we can't explain, but in some ways it's a mystery now that explains everything. Catherine Maury Lacuna, one of our great theologians, wrote, spectacular woman, went home to God way too young at 43 years of age, wrote this marvelous book on the Trinity. And she began her first page by saying, instead of saying it's a mystery we cannot explain, tell people it's a mystery that explains everything. Explains everything about who we are, who our God is, how we are to live our lives in love, in this triune, always in relationships of love. And so you lay out, you can spend a week doing or a day or whatever it is on the Blessed Trinity. But then instead of saying that, now boys and girls tell me, what is the Blessed Trinity? They said one God and three divine persons, distinct and equal, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, or Mother, Redeemer and Savior, whatever. But you're just getting them to feed back to you what you fed out to them. And if you wanted to go to their hearts, you'll have to ask them better questions. You'll have to say, now this old tradition, this old dogma, doesn't make any sense. Supposing you took it seriously, what would it mean for you? Can you imagine that you're made in the image and likeness of a God who is a triune loving relationship? What would it mean for your life? What would be the best way to live your life? Who could you become if you took this dogma, doctrine seriously? Because it has powerful meaning for us, but we so seldom uncover or discover the meaning it has. And supposing you put it to work in your life, how would you guide your loves? And how you would love, and why you would love, and who you would love. In other words, bring it out to some kind. Get them to try to see for themselves. So I think beginning with people's lives, issues, generative themes, heart's desires, what's going on, their own stories, their own visions, then in the midst of that, you'll have a far better sense of how to spin the story and vision of Christian faith, but then bring them back then to appropriate it, to make it their own, to see for themselves, rather than simply to repeat back what you told them. Let me bring you back into the conversation, and I'm going to definitely send you back to your neighbor just for 3 minutes before we end. What are your own responses to a life to faith, to life approach for your school? I haven't if you do want to read a little bit more about it, get a little more in-depth explanation of it, the chapter 8 and 9 of that book, Will There Be Faith? Which actually was the question Jesus himself raised. People wrote to me and said, Tom, how could you write a book called Will There Be Faith? I mean, isn't that a lack of faith on your part? And I said, you're right. I never would have raised the question if Jesus himself hadn't raised it first. And it's in Luke chapter 18, verse 8. And it's as if he's been rambling around the roads of Galilee for 3 years and he's heading into Jerusalem. Luke chapter 19 is the beginning of Holy Week. And he stops and he says, when I come again, when the Son of Man, that was his favorite title for himself in all four Gospels, so we're fairly sure, confident that he yet used it for himself. When I come again, will there be faith? Will there be faith on earth? It's a great question. So in your own school, it's a great question to wonder about. Those are of possibilities. Can we educate for faith? Or do we have to just teach kids about religion of some kind or other? Or can we also shape their lives? What can you do? Because you're all in positions of leadership of one kind or another. What can you do to support education for faith? Religious education, you're going to call it in your school? Okay. Think about that for a moment. Do you think the life to faith to life approach could have possibilities in your school? But maybe the last question is the more important. What will you do to encourage good religious education in whatever school you're in a leadership or management position of? Or maybe the best question, let me give you the last question. The last question I have for you, and if you want to write a note to yourself about this, because the most important question I've asked, that'll be the most important note you'll take. What did you learn in school today? In other words, when you go home and somebody says, well, was it any good? You say, well, a lot of the same old stuff, really, you know. This fight from America, the Bog of Allen, you know. Well, they say, yeah, but did you get anything at all out of it? What would you be sure to say? Take note. What would you be sure to say? Just think about it for a moment. Something you're taking away that might that might help you to take to heart, integrate into your context, and put to work. All right, would you go back to the neighbor and give them a little, we'll just take 3 minutes for this, but tell the neighbor, and of course, if you drew a blank in response to my question, that's a sure sign you should go back to the neighbor, because the neighbor always comes up with something, always. So have a chat with the neighbor and tell them what you're taking away and what you're going to put to work. All right? 3 minutes, we'll regather, here three people, and then we will end and wind down. Well, I hate to cut off good conversation, but give us a few thoughts, a few responses. Give us a gift, somebody. What you're taking away, what you'll take and put to work, maybe, that it will make a difference to how you go about things. That's the gold dust. Anybody want to share one with us?
Self-work.
Pardon?
Self-work.
Great one. It's a great one. Yeah.
Seeing Jesus as a personal teacher again, getting back to the childhood. My son's in first class now, and he's coming home with all these stories. We started with stories, and we move away from that.
Yeah.
Older, but I think it's time to go back to them.
Oh, yeah. Really oh, great stories.
And kids love stories.
And this will sound like an American visitor or somebody at home, but if there's anybody in the world that can tell stories, it's the Irish. Don't take that for granted. Not every people have that. I've been asked many times, people have come and said, where do you take your course in storytelling? My grandmother, my grandfather. I told Teddy a story the other day my grandmother told me when I was about 7 or 8 years old, and it has explained for me what St. Paul means by hope against hope. And it was a very simple story. We were churning. My mother was turning the churn. My grandmother was sitting up on the high stool giving out. And I finally said, Granny, will there ever be butter? Will there ever be butter? I don't think there's ever going to be butter. We've been churning and churning the milk. And she said, Tommy, did you ever hear the story of the two frogs? I said, no. And it's still with me. And she said, there were two little frogs. And they were playing around in the dairy up over the milk churns. And the two of them fell off the shelf and into an urn of milk, a half full urn of milk. And they splashed around and they splashed around and they splashed around. And they tried to jump out, but it was too high in the conical shape of the neck. They couldn't get out. And they kept trying to jump, but there was no way they were going to jump out of there. So finally, one little frog decided, this is useless, and sank to the bottom. The other frog said, no, I'll keep splashing. And he kept swimming and splashing and swimming and splashing. Eventually, of course, passed out. And he woke up sitting on a pile of butter. You knew the punchline. But I just said, but that's faith, that's hope. That's what St. Paul means by hope against hope. But like, where do we learn to tell stories? From our grandparents. And it's the most favored way. If you ever begin your class with a story, you'll definitely get people's attention. If you ever begin your sermon with a good story, you'll definitely get people's attention. Because people sit up and say, this could be about me. This could be interesting. It's a great one. And I think we still have the art. So use it. Use it well in religious education. It's a great one. Give us a couple more. What else are you going to do? What are you taking away from tonight that you might put to work yourself? Marie.
I'm going to come at this now from a very different angle, and I'm sorry, and I don't mean to be offensive or anything, but having listened to all this tonight and talking about stories, unfortunately, we Irish have other stories to tell. That are not as happy and not as favourable to our Catholic upbringing. And I'm asking myself, in schools where we're training our young people, how do we explain that to them?
We can't. It's so much of it is betrayal of the faith itself, a misrepresentation of it, a betrayal of it, a scandal to it. I don't think we can explain it away, but I don't think we should take away our faith either. that we somehow try to help people to distinguish between the richness of this faith tradition and the failures then of the institution that is supposed to represent it faithfully. Now, we've never represented it perfectly. The church will always be made up of saints and sinners. Saint Augustine arguing against the Donatists, that the Donatists want to let in the saints only. Augustine knew better. So we'll have to always welcome saints and sinners, which is why we're all welcome. And yet there are times and moments when we have sinned egregiously against the tradition, against the faith, desperately, the antithesis. So how do you yet cling to that faith in the midst of the scandals, the horrors? It's the grace of God if you do.
But does it not come back to what you were saying earlier about learning from?
You have to learn from it. Hopefully we learn from it, which is not to minimize the tragedy as if, well, and God can draw good out of evil. Now you have to be very careful how you say that. It's never that God never causes the evil. But God can draw good out of evil. And hopefully by God's grace, good can be drawn out of even dreadful evil. I sometimes do work with women in prisons, and I had a woman one night say to me, "Tom, I think God put me in here to bring me back to my faith." I said, "Mary, that's a lot of baloney. You're in here for robbing banks." But now that you're in here, God could bring you back to your faith. So you have to be very careful not to make it sound as if God did it to teach us a lesson. No, no. And yet, in the midst of it, we could come through it. It's possible, by the grace of God, to come through it a better people. And a people that never allows these type of things to ever happen again. But meanwhile, repentance, penance, reform is absolutely necessary. And I think the structures, the lack of accountability, we have structures in our church that have nothing at all to do with the gospel. They're the products of history that grew up, which isn't to say that they're wrong, but history produced them. History could deconstruct them and produce better ones. I think the exclusively male leadership in our church is a deep impoverishment. I think we have to face that. I don't think God has finished with us yet. But thank you for raising it, Marie. No, it's my God, the pain of the morning papers. Front page, Boston Globe, front page, New York Times, the Chewam story. But we can't let it have the last word. We'll have to reform, renew, and not repeat for sure. Blessings upon you. We're going on our way to Dublin for the night. Myself and Justin going out in the town. And thank you. I've loved being with you. Thank you very much.